Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. The U.S. Supreme Court ended its current term with a flurry of long-awaited decisions on issues like President Trump's travel ban, public sector labor union fees, and the warrantless collection of cell phone location data. The last of the rulings had scarcely come down when the bombshell dropped. Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement after 30 years on the High Court. That set off a flurry of a different kind, namely intense speculation about who would take his place and what might happen to key progressive rulings in which Kennedy served as the swing vote, including decisions on gay rights and abortion. Joining us to talk about all things Supreme Court are David Radofsky and Lisa Tucker. David is a University of Pennsylvania law professor and civil rights attorney with the firm of Carey's, Radofsky, Messing, Feinberg, and Lynn. And Lisa Tucker is associate professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
So, David, how significant has Justice Kennedy's role been on the court as we think about some of the most important decisions he's been involved in?
Yeah. Very significant, although I think he gets too much credit for being kind of a liberal block on that court. Certainly on gay and lesbian rights, he's been very important. Gay marriage would not have happened, I think, without Justice Kennedy in terms of what the Supreme Court said. He has been a little bit of a barrier, certainly on abortion rights, on the big picture issues. He has not gone with the justices on the court who would like to overrule Roe versus Wade, so he's been important in that respect. Strong advocate of First Amendment, although that cuts a lot of different ways. He was in the majority on Citizens United. He was in the majority this term on using free speech as a sword to, I think, harm labor unions and the California case, which we'll talk about in terms of abortion rights, but still quite significant on a court which has four very, very conservative members and four, I would say, moderate members at this point. He was that middle person, and he gets replaced, as he will now, with someone like Gorsuch, then I think we could see a significant change in that court.
Well, speaking of that, Lisa Tucker, what do you think his decision to retire is going to mean, not just for the court, but for the country?
I mean, I think that we're going to see this is the most consequential retirement we've had in modern court history because of the place that he held, where he so clearly was the swing vote on so many cases, and cases that I think really capture the American attention. You know, we're talking today about some cases that everybody's interested in: abortion, affirmative action, search and seizure, your cell phone, for gosh sake. And he was right in the center of all of these things. What happens now is that Trump has another pick, and Trump has been very, very clear, even giving a list of 25 people he's going to choose from, that he wants somebody not only in the model of Gorsuch, but I would be surprised if he didn't go even more conservative and younger than Gorsuch. They want somebody who's going to be on this court like Kennedy was for 30 years. If they can get 40, all the better.
Yeah, for a generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And what that does is it has this unbelievable ripple effect, because this person can participate in undoing some of what Justice Kennedy helped form and build, and then also make new law that lasts beyond them. It doesn't just last while they're on the court. It's going to affect our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
So President Trump talked about this the other night at his rally. I believe it was the one in Fargo. And we have a soundbite that I'd like both of you to hear, and then we can talk about it a little bit. But here it is.
We have a pick to come up. We have to pick a great one. We have to pick one that's going to be there for 40 years, 45 years. We need intellect. We need so many things to go. You know, there's so many elements go into the making of a great justice of the Supreme Court. You got to hit every one of them.
President Trump at a rally just the other night. David Radofsky, I'd like you to react to that. He's clearly signaling that he wants somebody young who's going to be there for a long time.
Oh, for sure. And we know from his first election and the process that went through and the candidates that emerged, that, you know, the top five were all the same old, young, very right wing in terms of their judicial philosophy, not afraid to upset the apple cart, to overrule past decisions, as we've seen this court do. And of course, and it's absolutely right, with Kennedy being the middle person, you've now, with this fifth person, right? It leaves kind of Roberts as kind of the middle person of the point, and Roberts is a thoroughly conservative person. When you look at this court, or what it will be once we have this new appointment, I think it'll be the most conservative, in fact, I would use the term reactionary court, that we've seen probably in 100 years.
Wow.
You have to go back to the early 1900s and then the 1930s, the fight against the Roosevelt New Deal, to see a court as conservative as this court will be. Now, having said that, it's not going to be that easy to undo everything that Kennedy kind of stood for. I don't think we're going to see the decision reversing gay marriage, for example. I think that would be extraordinary. It could happen, but I doubt it. So some things, because culturally and politically, have solidified this country. And that's where the fight has to be from the other side to make sure that there's a strong feeling that cuts against what they want to do.
So I'm not sure I agree completely with Dave. I agree with a lot of what Dave is saying. But first of all, I think some things will be undone. I think particularly with the labor unions case that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, we saw the court's willingness to say, we really don't care that much about precedent. And that has always been the stalwart of the Supreme Court. That's how people know what the law is, how people can predict what they should do in the future. And in Janus, this case about labor unions, the court said there's been this 40-year-old case. We've been doing this the same way for 40 years, and we held this, and that is no longer. So I think with respect to people who are saying, oh, you know, it's settled law and they won't overrule it. And, you know, of course, Chief Justice Roberts said that in his confirmation hearings. I think that's worth the paper that it's written on. I also think that there's a lot of stuff that Justice Kennedy left unfinished. So, for example, Dave just mentioned gay marriage. And I do agree with Dave that I don't think gay marriage is going anywhere, in part because of the practicality of unwinding that. I mean, what's going to happen to all these people who are now married, right? But we still have sexual orientation being a basis for discrimination in many, many states. It's never been subjected to heightened scrutiny by the court. And I think that cause is lost now. I don't think that we're going to see the court saying, no, you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. I also think with respect to the death penalty, a couple of terms ago, Justice Kennedy said, almost in so many words, I'd really like somebody to bring me a case about solitary confinement. I think that there's a really good chance that that would violate the Eighth Amendment, that it would be cruel and unusual punishment. And we haven't seen that case yet. And that is something that seemed to be something Justice Kennedy cared about a great deal that his successor may not.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that we'd love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call at 888-477-9499. If you'd like to email a question or comment for our guests, it's radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've been talking about, I'm sorry, David, you want to?
It was just one piece of unfinished business with Kennedy, which is interesting, which is that gerrymandering redistricting issue, which is so important to our political process. I mean, it's so corrupt now across this country in terms of the gerrymandering that's taken place. And again, you had a court that was split 4-4, right? Four saying, we don't interfere with that. State legislatures do what they want. Four willing to look at it in extreme cases. And Kennedy kind of joining the liberal just in theory and saying, well, maybe, right? Bring me the right case, and maybe I'm willing to look at and overrule the way redistricting and gerrymandering takes place. He had his opportunity this year. The case got dismissed on technical grounds. That's unfinished business. I suspect that the next justice will go with the other four, and it'll be very, very difficult, in the future, particularly given what they've done to the Voting Rights Act, to see much change in terms of that political process.
Lisa? Yeah, and I think that those of us who follow the court obsessively, and, you know, my husband's a huge Philadelphia Eagles fan, and, you know, you can't tear him away from that. That's how I feel about the Supreme Court. So this week every year is the most exciting week of my year. This is my Super Bowl. And we saw a bunch of cases that seemed like they were sort of kicking the can down the road over the last couple of weeks, like these gerrymandering cases, yeah. Like the case about baking a cake.
The wedding cake.
Right, for a same-sex couple. And they seemed to, like, kind of not be wanting to decide anything. And I said at the time, especially with the wedding cake, this is Kennedy's issue. You know, the liberty and dignity of especially same-sex couples. And I said, I really wonder if he just is saying, not on my watch.
Well, and
I'm leaving. It's not on my watch. You know, we're just going to kick this right now and you guys deal with it later.
There was some speculation about that, that perhaps the court was waiting for the next long-term jurist to come on board, knowing that there was a likelihood that Kennedy might retire. And, hey, let's put this off because it's likely to circle back to us anyway. You've both mentioned a couple of cases that were unfinished business that may be likely to come back around, David.
Yeah. Well, the wedding cake case is interesting, but it also shows Kennedy's kind of two sides. On the one hand, certainly historically, very strong on this question of dignity of all people, gay and lesbians included. And so an impulse to say, wait a minute, if you're in a commercial business and you're making something for a wedding, you can't discriminate against who's getting married. On the other hand, what he finally does in that case is to say, well, Baker wasn't treated properly in the state court proceedings. They seemed to be antagonistic to his religious beliefs. I mean, Kennedy was a strong proponent of religious rights. And so when that conflict came between the dignity, right, of gay and lesbians and the religious beliefs of the Baker, I think he felt himself in the middle, actually, on that one.
And we saw other cases. I know we're going to talk about the travel ban case in a few minutes. We saw other cases where this idea of hostility towards religion was coming up. And we again saw him vote with the, no, you know, we need to see real evidence of hostility towards religion.
Yeah. We were talking about the idea of a young jurist coming on board, but on the opposite end of that, we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is 85 this year, and that, of course, raises the question, could we see ourselves in this same scenario in the not-too-distant future, David?
Well, yeah, that's a question for sure. You know, something will depend on how the Senate goes also in the fall. I mean, this justice will be voted on before the election in November is my guess. But if the Democrats can't take back the Senate, then you've got at least two more years of Trump. Certainly Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Thomas is not young. Justice Breyer is not young. So hard to predict. I think Justice Ginsburg will try to stay at least for the next couple of years, for sure.
But do you think that she wants to stay on at least?
She will not leave
Trump's term.
Not voluntarily.
She will not leave voluntarily. No. The one thing we know is that it won't be a voluntary resignation. She will stay there until the last possible moment. Is my guess.
But I think it's important for us to talk about that. I do agree with respect to Justice Ginsburg, but I have two points that I think are really important. First of all, a few years ago, you and I were talking, Tracy. And I was asked about retirements, and I said, you know, I think we're going to have a death first. And I didn't mean to be morbid about it, but sure enough, that's what happened with Justice Scalia, right? Somebody dies. And that comes completely unexpectedly, or somebody is so ill. So, for example, when Thurgood Marshall retired, people were like, how can you be doing this during a Bush presidency? And he said, I'm sick and I'm old. What do you want me to do, right? So we may be in a position where somebody doesn't have a choice. Somebody does die, or somebody is in very ill health. Or I think that we might want to think about, why should we have given Justice Kennedy a pass? You've done a good job, dude. Your time has come.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We'll be right back. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we have been talking about all things Supreme Court. Specifically, we have been talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire, but we'll also be talking about some of the major decisions that came down from the Supreme Court in the last couple of weeks. We're talking with attorneys David Rudofsky and Lisa Tucker. David, of course, is University of Penn Law Professor. Lisa Tucker, an Associate Professor of Law at Drexel. We've been talking about Justice Kennedy, and we haven't talked about possible replacements. President Trump already has said that he's got a long list of possibilities that he's been carrying around for some time. Lisa, who do you expect might be the nominee?
Well, I think we can speak generally about that, and then we can speak more specifically. There's just no doubt that this nominee will be quite young. In the clip that you played in the first segment, he said, I want 40, 45 years out of this person. Well, think about it. If he appoints a 45-year-old, that person has to serve until she's 90, right? So somebody's going to be quite young. And Justice Thomas went on the court when he was, I believe, 43. So this is not unheard of. The second thing is this person is going to be an originalist. And of course, originalism is this idea that the Constitution means what it meant at the founding, right here in Philadelphia when they drafted the Constitution. So the person is going to subscribe to the idea that we don't get to interpret the Constitution according to today's norms and today's values. We have to look back to
in light of what
exactly what the people who wrote it meant, right? In terms of specifics, I think a lot of people on his list might be there to show that he's got, you know, some chutzpah, a little bit of gravitas, but they're too old. I was looking through the list yesterday, and at least seven or eight of them are over 60. So those people, they're out of the question. I also think that there are very few people of color, very few minorities on this list. The list is largely made up of white men. Again, I don't think that's a huge surprise. But, you know, also listening to that clip that you played, I think it's really interesting what President Trump said. And I hadn't heard that clip before, but he said, there are so many important things. This is really important. But he didn't say what those things were. And the thing that worries me is, does he know what those things are? Now, the Federalist Society, which is the organization of very conservative lawyers in this country, has been advising him. And I think he will rely very, very heavily on what they said. One possible, I think, pick might be Thomas Hardiman, who's here in Pennsylvania on the Third Circuit. He's got a great life story. He drove a cab to support himself going to law school, and he's been a very conservative judge. He was also what they say was the runner-up to Justice Gorsuch in the last one. So if he's on the short list, President Trump might feel like it'd be kind of mean to put him in the finalists again and not pick him. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, and you can also look at what he's done in the lower courts. You know, we're focusing on the Supreme Court. He's had an equal, if not greater, impact on the lower federal courts, both the Court of Appeals and district judges. And it's been the Federalist Society, which has basically have been selecting those judges. And if you look at the profile there, white, male, young, conservative, across the board.
Like, I mean, crazy conservative. Yeah. I don't mean crazy like mentally ill, but I mean like super duper conservative.
A few women, very few people of color, and so that shows you what he's thinking about for the Supreme Court. You know, as to individuals, I think there's probably a group of five or six that they're looking at very closely.
The name Kavanaugh comes up a lot.
Kavanaugh comes up, Pryor from the South, you know, that it's they're all kind of the same mold in a lot of ways in terms of we know because they've written already as Court of Appeals judges, quite conservative. Conservative originalists in their theory, and likely to follow the path of the very right wing justices that we have now. So it'll be one of that group, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the Federalist Society and therefore the Trump administration want to make sure that they avoid stealth candidates. And what I mean by that is, for example, David Souter. David Souter was not was appointed by a Republican president, but he ended up being much more liberal than anybody expected. So they want to make sure this person is hardcore, has the record to prove it, and isn't going to get on this court for a lifetime and then be able to do whatever they want.
Yeah, they're looking at predictability for sure. I want to remind our listeners that you can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Before we move on to talk about some of these key decisions that have come down, I'd like you to react to a quote from Mitch McConnell. And this was from last year, and it was at the time of Justice Neil Gorsuch's confirmation when he said, quote, "As I look back on my career, I think the most consequential decision I've ever been involved in was the decision to let the president being elected in 2016 pick the Supreme Court nominee." So that's the quote. The question is, a couple of things. One, how was the Senate able to get away with refusing to confirm Merrick Garland? And how significant is what Mitch McConnell said in light of what we're seeing happen today, David?
Yeah. Well, we know what they did. They stole the seat. They had a majority in the Senate. They wouldn't allow it even to come out of committee. They just, it was political power. It was a political power play, kind of unprecedented justice who died, 18 months before the next presidential election in that range. And it was pure political power play, right? They thought if they could win the election, which they did, they'd have the appointment. It was an important appointment, and we've seen already how it's affected the court. So no surprise there, and no surprise that they will push this one through before the November election. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, there's no Democratic way to avoid it. Filibuster is out. They can overrule it. They've got the 50 votes.
Right. They do have the 50 votes. The hopes seem to be lying or hanging on a couple of female senators who might say, well, things like Roe v. Wade are important enough to us that we would consider flipping on this. But I think there are a couple of things we have to remember. One is that we've got a long time until this election. I mean, the Democrats would have to manage to hold the line for months. The second thing is that, yes, they want to push it through and they don't care about their rule. But the third thing I think we need to think about is the fact that we currently have a president who is under criminal investigation. And the fact that a president who's under criminal investigation could be in the position of appointing a Supreme Court justice is, to me, mind-boggling. And so, for example, yesterday, Cory Booker, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, while this is going on, until this investigation concludes and President Trump is cleared, we should hold off on, looking at any nominee that he puts forward. And I think that that's a rule that would come into play very rarely and also is intellectually honest.
Yeah. Go ahead, David. Did you want to say
something? No. I think it's right. I think they will play that. You're right. I think to the extent, but of course, you know what these nominees are going to say. Even if they come in thinking, boy, I'd love to overrule Roe versus Wade. I can't talk about it. I'll respect precedent. I mean, they are right. they are scripted in these hearings. Unless there's something so clear that would move a couple of the kind of moderate Republican women senators, I think there's very little chance of stopping this appointment.
Yeah, I hate to agree with Dave, but I do.
You've both mentioned Roe v. Wade, and I do want to take a moment to ask a question from one of our listeners. Candida wants to know, what would it look like long term if Roe v. Wade is overturned? Lisa.
So I think that's a really important question she's asking. I think the first thing we need to know is that even if it were if we had this new justice on the court who was going to overrule Roe v. Wade, this is going to take a little bit of time. It takes time for a case to get to the court, then it takes time for the court to hear it and decide it. And then in most cases, it would take time for state legislatures to pass laws and for a governor to sign off. It absolutely would be the case that abortion would still be legal in many places. Overruling Roe v. Wade does not say abortion is illegal. It just says states can make it illegal if they want to. So I think that we have some time on that, and I think there will still be places where abortion is safe and accessible and legal, but certainly it would diminish, particularly for poor women, their access to abortion.
Well, CNN's Jeffrey Toobin said something interesting the other day. He said that once this new jurist is in place, he believes that abortion will be illegal in 20 states in 18 months. David, do you agree with that?
I think not that quickly. I'm not convinced that Justice Roberts would join that. I mean, I think he's certainly anti-abortion. Whether he would go for overruling Roe versus Wade, I'm not sure. The others, I think, would. 18 months seems like a very short time for a case to get started and get up there. But certainly in 2 or 3 years, certainly possible. But Lisa's right. I think what we'd then have is a complete bifurcation in this country, right? You'd have 20 states that would not make it illegal. You'd have a significant number of states that made it illegal. Poor women would not be able to travel. And so you'd have this kind of crazy bifurcation of this country as to where you have the rights and where you don't.
As if we don't already.
Right.
Before we move on to talk about some of the specific cases, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this and whether you think that going forward, Democrats, both Democratic voters and candidates, will be more mindful of Supreme Court justices. And by that I mean that it seems to me that Republicans have been more mindful when they vote, particularly in presidential elections, about who this president is going to put on the Supreme Court, perhaps, than Democrats have been. Do you think that this is a wake-up call to Democrats and that perhaps Supreme Court justice picks will be a greater priority in terms of what happens in the ballot box, Lisa?
I wish I could say yes. I think my answer has to be no. I think that Republicans have caught on to this better than Democrats have. And I think one of the great things about shows like this is that we really can hammer home to people that what the Supreme Court does actually affects you personally and your day-to-day life. I think so many people think, you know, there's this white marble building on this hill in D.C. and these people in robes, and what does that have to do with me? But it really does have to do with you. And I think the Democrats have been bad at getting out that message. And I think that that needs to improve. I don't think it's going to improve in time.
Yeah. David?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly Republicans have played that card much better. The evangelical vote in 2016 for Trump shows that, you know, they played to them for the Supreme Court. I think it's a combination not only of the court, but of the reaction to Trump. I mean, the Democratic turnout in the primaries in the last couple of years in the elections has been higher than it was generally in off year. So I think it's both a combination of what's going on in the Supreme Court, but the anti-Trump movement itself, you'd hope, will generate more voting by Democrats because it's been very low.
Yeah. Going to be very, very interesting to watch for sure. Want to remind our listeners, you can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email your questions to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Want to talk about some of these key rulings that have come down just this week alone. And one of them was about public employee unions, Janus versus AFSCME. And interesting ruling that many people are concerned could have a major effect on public sector employee unions. Lisa, what was the question that the court was being asked to decide in that case?
Well, in that case, what we had was a guy who was a child support specialist. He worked for the state Health and Human Services, or whatever the department was in the state. And he was not a member of the public sector union in his state, but he had to pay what's called an agency fee. And an agency fee is the money that goes to the union for their collective bargaining efforts. So to help people have better working conditions, higher pay, et cetera. And the philosophy has always been that the union is doing this collective bargaining on behalf of the union members, but it also benefits the non-union members because they end up with the same great deal, right? So about 40 years ago, the Supreme Court said there are really two things unions do. One is political activity, lobbying, supporting candidates. The other is this collective bargaining role. And they said it's clear that you can't make people pay money to support the political piece. But yes, you can pay money to make people support this collective bargaining piece. So this week, Wednesday, the court said, actually, never mind. Right? They said, these things are really tangled up. And it's hard to separate the two things, hard enough that we're going to say that you can't make these, quote, free riders, people who aren't paying the fees but still are getting the benefit, you can't make them pay, because that would be tantamount to making them support views that they don't agree with.
I'm Tracy Matisak, and you are listening to Radio Times with Marty Moscowane here on WHYY in Philadelphia. David, you were saying.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting also about this case is I mentioned before using the First Amendment as a sword, right? So now this is a sword really at the throat of labor unions. I mean, it's public employee unions who are going to be very, very hurt by this. As Justice Breyer said in dissent, why should anybody pay at this point, right? I mean, even those who support the union.
Why should you stay in the union?
Yeah. I mean, you've got free riders, right? I mean, you've got basically a free ride. It's going to be very harmful. But it's not an isolated situation in which the court has used the First Amendment as this kind of sword. We saw what happened in Citizens United, right, in terms of campaign finance, the First Amendment right of corporations to speak, right, overrides corruption in the political process. And we saw it as well in the case, you know, involving abortion tangentially in California, striking down the California law, right, that required these crisis centers, pregnancy crisis centers, to inform women of options other than adoption. That you can have abortion in California. And so this is kind of and the same thing with religion. You know, we've seen that to the extent that the court wouldn't go as far as it should have in the Masterpiece Baker case. Using freedom of religion and First Amendment, right, to support corporations anti-union, right, and anti-gay and lesbian. I mean, that's a mark of this court.
And at the same time, we have this really strange counterpart. So, for example, one of the things that came up in the case, and this case in California that Dave is referring to, involved crisis pregnancy centers that did not offer abortions, in many cases didn't even offer medical services, but offered counseling to pregnant women and required them to say, yes, there are other options for you, including abortions and including low-fee abortions that you could actually access. And the court said, no, you can't do that. But on the other hand, Justice Breyer said in dissent, well, wait a minute. We have said it's okay to require abortion providers to inform women that adoption is an option. And I think he said something like, what's normally sauce for the goose is also sauce for the gander. What's going on here? And that's what we're talking about in terms of consistency in the law. And that's why stare decisis, the concept of precedent, is so important. And what we saw here, this came up in the travel ban case as well, was the court being willing to sort of play with past law and massage it and say, well, that doesn't really apply to get them to the place that they wanted to be in the end.
Yeah. So how badly will this affect labor unions, A, and the Democratic Party, because public unions do tend to support the Democrats?
Well, you just had to hear Trump after that decision came down. You know, great decision, hurts the Democrats, hurts unions. And look, this is an administration that, as much as it says, you know, it's for the middle class and working people, virtually everything it's done has been for corporations and not very helpful to working people. This is a court that not only this term, but previously, when you look at their rulings on class actions, on requirement of arbitration, right, on access to the courts, have made it very difficult for poor people, for unions, for laborers, right, for consumers, right, to do anything in terms of judicial challenges. The decisions on arbitration really take away the right to a trial for many, many people in a variety of circumstances, kind of pro-corporate. And that's all these cases are in line with that.
Yeah. The travel ban was another one of those big decisions that came down. We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We'll be right back. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and we are talking about all things Supreme Court today. We've been talking about the retirement announcement of Justice Anthony Kennedy and also about some of the key rulings that have come down just this week, not the least of which was the ruling on public sector labor unions and, of course, the travel ban. Our guests are Lisa Tucker. She's an associate professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas Klein School of Law. Also, David Rudofsky is with us. He is a University of Penn law professor. And we want to talk about the travel ban because that was a huge decision that came down this week. Third iteration of the travel ban for President Trump. And it sounds, Lisa, as if the court is saying that this seems to be more about the president's authority in matters of national security than it is about whatever anti-Muslim statements he may have made, whatever personal feelings he may have, that it's kind of more about power than about perceived prejudice. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's certainly a lot about power, Tracy. I was at the courtroom on Tuesday when the court announced this decision. Chief Justice Roberts announcing it, and then, of course, Justice Sotomayor just passionately speaking for a very long time about how strongly she disagreed. But when we're talking about the travel ban, remember that, if we can just review, this was President Trump saying that people from other countries couldn't come into the United States. And ostensibly, it was about that these countries hadn't filled out disclosure forms about various things. And so if you don't fill out our disclosure form, you don't get to come in. At the same time, President Trump had been tweeting and, you know, rallying and on his campaign website saying, you know, Muslims are bad. We don't want Muslims here. We're going to keep them out. So there were some people who said, well, it's really just about these countries being dangerous. And the others were like, no, it's about the fact that Trump doesn't want Muslims here. So this went up to the court on that basis, about can we keep people out on that basis. And the first part of it was, indeed, does the president even have the power to do this? And yeah, the court looked at the statute, the immigration statute, and said, yes, it seems pretty clear based on the language of this statute that President Trump did have the power to issue this executive order. So then the second question they had to look at was, what was motivating it? And they said, really, it seems to have been about these disclosure things, because in fact, eventually a couple of the countries did fill out the disclosure things, and then the ban was lifted for them. So they said, even though there were all these statements about anti-Muslim sentiment, that doesn't matter as much as the fact that, you know, he really was saying it's about disclosure. And what's so interesting to me about that is that in the same-sex wedding cake case that we talked about a minute ago, where the court said, you know, the Colorado Commission seemed to have some hostility towards the Baker's religion. Very sort of subtle statements that were made. And here we had overt statements that were made, and the court said, well, no, that's really not enough. And that's where Justice Sotomayor jumped in and said, are you kidding me? And we sat there for about 20 minutes listening to, she's so powerful when she speaks. And the courtroom was so silent, you could have heard a pin drop. And you could really hear people hearing her agony over this.
Yeah. And I want to come back to that dissent, because that was important. And David, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because the president's detractors, and including in this case even some Christian groups, have said it's hard not to see this as religious discrimination, especially in light of those past comments that Lisa was referencing. Now, the court says that the remarks are extrinsic. They don't really matter. It doesn't really mention, the ban doesn't necessarily mention Muslims, so it's not discriminatory. But then there are people who say, well, wait a minute, you look at the wedding cake case, how does this all make sense?
And the way the majority dealt with that issue, because they had to deal with it, right? The wedding cake case, we had this commission in Colorado making some adverse comments about religion, and therefore that poisoned the whole well, and therefore we're going to, you know, reverse their ruling as to the Baker. If you apply that standard in this case, the travel ban goes down. What the court does on a kind of little bit of turn here is to say, well, we're dealing with immigration, we're dealing with national security, therefore the First Amendment religious rights are less important. It's what they call rational basis review. Is there any basis on which we can justify this? We've got national security, we've got the immigration where the president generally has a lot of power. We're going to apply a different standard, even though it's more overt, even though it's more direct, even though the evidence is overwhelming that this was motivated by an anti-Muslim bias in this administration and this president. We're going to ignore that in this kind of situation. Again, a hallmark of this court. As much as they trump First Amendment rights, years ago they upheld a conviction, a significant First Amendment case, of someone who gave supposed support to a group that had been labeled as a terrorist group in Turkey, even though it was – what was the support? It was school books. It was money for medical care, certainly usually protected by the First Amendment. But no, in that kind of context where we think it's terrorism, we're going to call it something else. And so easy to kind of manipulate this doctrine, which is, I think, exactly what happened here. The interesting thing about Sotomayor is both how passionate she was, but she is now emerging as the one – very liberal voice. I mean, the four on the left of this court, when you say left, are really moderates. And when you think back historically, Brennan and Marshall and Douglas and Black, I mean, you had people who really were to some extent progressive. it was hard to find a progressive on this court. Sotomayor, I think, is now emerging as the progressive voice on the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Lisa, what was it like in the courtroom when she read that dissent?
Well, yeah, the first thing you have to understand, Tracy, is how unusual it is for a justice to read a dissent from the bench. The court likes to be seen as a uniform body. And even where they disagree behind the scenes and in writing, they like to look like, you know, okay, you know, we're going with this majority rule. So it's only when a justice feels so strongly that she will choose to read from the bench. And of course, the notorious RBG has a special collar that she wears, a little, you know, frilly thing on her robe. Justice Sotomayor was stinking mad. She basically just called the court to task and said, this is pretext. You know, you care about one religion, you don't care about another religion, you don't care about these people, you know, who are being discriminated against. This is going to have horrible slippery slope effect. And the court keeps doing this over and over and over again. And I think, you know, the message underneath what she was saying was this distrust for the Trump administration. And I think it's very likely, although I don't know for sure, that Masterpiece was several days ago at this point. The travel ban was on Tuesday. Justice Kennedy retired on Wednesday. I think it's very likely that the other justices knew by this point that that was going to happen and that she was sending a broader message out there. There was one more interesting thing that happened that day that I think hasn't gotten as much attention, and that had to do with the Korematsu case. The Korematsu case was a case from World War II, and it had to do with the internment of Japanese American citizens. And the court in Korematsu said, this is okay because of national security. And most people in the country, conservatives and liberals alike, have seen this as just, you know, a blight on the Supreme Court's history. Yeah. And the Chief Justice did say, we today are officially saying that Korematsu was wrong. It was wrong when it was decided. It's wrong today. And for some people, that was the tiny little silver lining that came out of the travel ban.
Although Justice Sotomayor said, wait a minute, that's what you're doing here, right? I mean, it's easy to say, right? What we did 60 years ago was terrible, right? Yeah. And we're not going to do it. But look what you're doing today. And in 40 years, are people going to be saying the same thing?
Oh, yeah.
We have a caller who's been waiting very patiently to join us in this conversation, Henry from Warwick, who has a question about the court in general. Henry, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Your question for our guests.
Earlier today on the Morning Joe program, they had a specialist in the courts that mentioned in the past history there had been numbers of Supreme Court justices changed from 5 to 7 to 11 and then back and so forth. And I was just wondering what that might impact in the future, people selecting a particular conservative or liberal judge. Could a president do that, or Congress, a senator?
Well, Henry, thanks for your question. That's an interesting idea. Well, I was not aware of that.
Well, the last time that came up is with Roosevelt, right?
Yeah, right. The court packing.
You remember we had Roosevelt in the New Deal and a very conservative court striking down a lot of the progressive legislation in the 1930s. Roosevelt's idea was to, quote, pack the court, increase the membership of the court. He would get the appointments. And what was interesting with that, there was a huge public resistance to that. Even though most people thought the Supreme Court was too conservative, that it was unfair to be striking down what Congress had passed in terms of labor rights and economic rights, you don't do it by kind of, quote, packing the court. I don't think we're going to see that at this point. I think at this point we've got the nine, very dangerous territory for anybody to say one way or the other, I want to change the court by increasing the membership.
And the Constitution does not say how many justices are on the Supreme Court. It just says there is one Supreme Court. It is established by statute now. So Congress has decided that there are nine, and I guess that could be changed. But that seems so unlikely. Yeah. I really don't see that.
Question from Twitter. It says, I'd like to know what types of checks and balances are available on the Supreme Court. What power do states have? And is there an appeals process? I think you touched a little bit on that in talking about Roe v. Wade and how states have some latitude regardless of the decision. But interesting question. Are there checks and balances? And what recourse do the states have, David?
Well, you know, there are state courts. And it's a very important question because while the Supreme Court can rule as to federal law, state Supreme Courts can and have, in many instances, say that state constitutions give broader rights. Now, that, of course, only applies in that state. Pennsylvania is a good example, for example.
I think New Jersey is, too, isn't it?
Yeah. New Jersey. But so just as an example, over the past 40 years, as the Supreme Court has become more conservative after the Warren Court, state Supreme Court has rejected a number of their rulings and saying the state constitution provides greater rights, whether it's in the First Amendment area, the Fourth Amendment area in terms of search and seizure. They can do it as to abortion, right? They could say the state constitution protects abortion in this state. Legislature can't overrule that. But, of course, that's limited. We're talking only that law is only then applicable in that one particular state.
And sort of a related question, and this was an email from Fred, and it says, can the court easily buck what a majority of Americans think on abortion and other issues? So I guess maybe the question is, to what degree does the court take into consideration the prevailing mood of the country, Lisa?
So if you asked a justice of the Supreme Court, he or she would say not at all. They say that when there are these protests outside of the court, they don't pay any attention. It's just a pain in the butt for them because, you know, all the police officers are out there and it's loud. Practically, there have been lots of studies done that show that the court doesn't tend to stray too far from public opinion. It doesn't tend to get out in front, and it doesn't tend to be too far behind. So to the extent that the Supreme Court says we're not a political body and we don't care, you know, we're just on the law, we know that not to be fully true.
Yeah. Some interesting questions raised as well about voting rights, some gerrymandering cases that the court either considered or did not consider. And there was another case in Ohio about purging voter rolls. Some interesting things going on around voter rights, David.
Yeah, well, this is a court that's very deferential to states in terms of whether it's voting rolls, gerrymandering, redistricting, which, of course, permits a lot of actions by states that that suppress the vote and suppress the vote of minorities and suppress the vote of poor people. We've seen that empirically across the country. This court has refused to step in. I mentioned before Justice Kennedy was kind of in the middle of that, thinking that if it gets that extreme, I might be willing to step in, but never quite did. And so I think we're going to continue to see a court that will allow states to do almost anything. This is a court that struck down the Voting Rights Act.
Very key provisions.
Not the entire act, but very key provisions. Kennedy joined that opinion. That was a 5-4 opinion that's had a significant impact on voting in this country. So I think on that one, we are stuck with a court, and we will be stuck with a court that's going to allow the state by state, to suppress voting rights.
I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The whole voting rights issue and the gerrymandering in particular is interesting. I know that there was the case of racial gerrymandering in Texas that raised a lot of questions, but also one in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And I think that one was sent back. And if you expect these cases to circle back around to the Supreme Court at some point.
A number have reached the court. I mean, the lower courts have been divided on the question of their authority, the federal court's authority to overrule what states are doing in this area. We had litigation in Texas, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, interestingly, right? That this is a good example of the state Supreme Court. Pennsylvania
that
State
was just
Supreme
3 or 4 months ago.
That's right. Pennsylvania State Supreme Court said the way you're districting in Pennsylvania violates the Pennsylvania Constitution. And a very good example of a state being able to do that, the court redrew the districts in Pennsylvania much more fairly. That's going to have some impact in November. The opponents of that, the legislature, went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said overrule it. The Supreme Court refused to step in and said Pennsylvania Supreme Court has the authority under its own constitution to do it. So, again, it's going to be this state-by-state process.
Yeah. And if we have a new jurist on the court by the time that these cases circle back, which in all likelihood we will, Lisa, what do you think we'll see happening as it relates to voting rights issues, to gerrymandering and so forth?
Right. So, you know, when we gerrymander, we're trying to steer a specific electoral outcome, right? You want to make it either, if you're doing partisan gerrymandering, you're trying to put all the people that are part of your party into one district. Racially, you're kind of predicting that people of certain races will vote a certain way, so you try to get them diluted or concentrated. I would expect that the next justice would be very, very slim on voting rights, would be very, very slim on, you know, saying that something is racially based, for example, and that we really may see more limitations, or if not limitations, less practical access for voters.
Yeah. So many interesting decisions that have come down just in the last few weeks when you think about digital privacy, sports betting, voting rights, so many things for us to keep an eye on in the months to come, especially as we watch to see who this new Supreme Court justice will be. Let me take a moment to thank our guests, Lisa Tucker, David Rudofsky. Thank you both so much for being with us and helping us understand all of these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.